Good morning, everyone. Here's a roundup of the latest domestic and foreign news. This morning finds the great battles along the Russian front continuing. An on-the-spot report is brought to us now direct from the Soviet capital as we switch to Robert Magadov in Moscow.
The resistance of the Red Army is stiffening to the south of Millerovo. Sensing this and fearing that their breakthrough towards Stalingrad and Rostov might be bottled up, the Germans have worked up their pressure to a fury of fire and metal. Their tanks and divisions are surging forward despite heavy losses. Hundreds of bombers are raiding Russian positions and settlements behind the lines. Parachutists are landing in the Soviet rear. Cities and villages are perishing in flames, and acres of this year's bumper crop are devastated by fire and tanks. But the Russians are not taking it lying down. Hundreds of their own planes are counteracting the Luftwaffe. Land troops are constantly harassing enemy flanks. The Red Army even launched two counterattacks yesterday, striking with such force that the Germans were compelled to withdraw in one sector. On the main, however, the Russians are still on the retreat toward new positions, but at a much slower pace and hitting back with greater force. At Voronezh, the Germans continue to dig in the face of determined Russian counterattacks. The Red Army yesterday recaptured a number of settlements on the northern approaches to Voronezh, while near its southern gates it routed the 75th German Infantry Division. Violent fighting continues in the region of the city itself, where the Germans are contesting every street and every house. For instance, it took the Russians a whole night of heavy fighting to capture a four-story building. Two German battalions resisted to the last man, resisted even after the first two floors were in the hands of the Russians. Voronezh now is half ruined. Its population has been evacuated. Some of its finest buildings have been reduced to ashes. Goodbye from Moscow.
And for the news from Capitol Hill, we turn to Richard Harkness of the Washington Bureau of the Philadelphia Inquirer, who reports from our nation's capital.
Washington's biggest war story comes today from Alaska. The Japanese have taken another one of the Aleutian Islands. This time it's Agatu. Just what the Japanese want with Agatu isn't clear. The island is 750 miles west of Dutch Harbor. Our military men didn't think it was worth defending, but the Japs thought it was worth taking. It is significant, perhaps, that military experts call the Aleutians the back steps to North America. Operations on the Alaskan front are hidden in fog today, a fog that covers that section of the Pacific this time of year, and a fog of censorship, too. But this much is known. The Japs are paying a high price for their conquest. American submarines and bombers have sunk or damaged 13 Japanese warships. They've shot down 7 Japanese planes. Developments in Alaska are likely to have repercussions here at home. The Senate Military Affairs Committee wants to investigate. It wants to send a delegation to the northern frontier to see why our Army and Navy permitted the enemy to gain a toehold. If the Senate approves money for the probe, it will be the first time that Congress has taken a hand in the conduct of the war. The Army and Navy wouldn't call it taking a hand. They'd call it meddling. While the country is puzzling over Alaska, it becomes plainer than ever that we plan to win the war in the air. The War Department is organizing the world's largest and most powerful airborne army. Before long, we'll be transporting our fighting men to world fronts in giant planes and gliders. The new army branch already is underway. It will be called the Troop Carrier Command. Special training will be given in transporting parachutists and infantrymen to theaters of operation. General Arnold, Chief of the Army Air Corps, is calling for volunteers. Washington is looking to the White House today to see what Mr. Roosevelt is going to do about wages. The problem was laid on the president's doorstep the other day when the War Labor Board gave little steel workers a raise of 44 cents a day. Now the CIO is out to get more money for every one of its 500,000 members working in steel plants. So the problem is right on the president's lap. The wage situation is expected to cause the president to send a special message to Congress next week on inflation. He probably will ask for legislation to stabilize the country's payrolls. Also, he may ask Congress for additional power to clamp down on farm prices. Also, There may be a presidential request for money to keep subsidies. For subsidies to keep the cost of living from jumping sky high. The House winds up 3 days of debate on the tax bill this afternoon. Under House rules, the bill can't be amended. But Representative Knudsen, a Republican from Minnesota, wants to send the measure back to committee with instructions to lower the stiff war tax on American business. The news carries a smile sometimes, even these days. Out in Indianapolis, John Zazas is suing the Republican State Committee for $8,000. The Republicans bought 67,000 whistles and 500 horns back in 1936 to welcome Alf Landon to town, and Zazas never got his money. And that's all from Washington.
And now to David Anderson in Stockholm.
Hello, New York. This is David Anderson speaking from Stockholm. News from the Russian front today is anything but encouraging. If we accept the German claims to have cut the railway line from the Donetsk region to Stalingrad, east of the Donetsk, and last night's claim that the Germans are now in possession of Voroshilovgrad, then it seems as though the German intentions are pretty well outlined. Again, citing German reports, the line now seems to extend from Kursk to somewhere in the region of Voronezh, then it extends southeastwardly toward Bogotar. In the region of Milarova, the line seems to divide, one swinging southeastwardly, east of the Donetsk, and the other in a wide circle via Voroshilovgrad to Taganrog. If you should outline these theoretical lines on a map, you will soon discover that the evident German intentions are to encircle the Russian forces in this pocket. It'll be recalled that the Germans began an offensive in the region of Taganrog several days ago, but little has been heard of the progress so far. It is possible that Russian resistance in this region proved to be too strong for any rapid progress, and that the Germans have preferred to make their drive on Rostov in the rear. In other words, by driving southwestwardly from their positions east of the Donetsk. If this plan as outlined turns out to be correct, then it is evident that the Germans have chosen to create a favorable starting basis for their offensive into the Caucasus, without carrying their eastward drive as far as the Volga. If the Germans succeed in capturing Rostov, their chances for opening up their drive into the Caucasus are extremely bright, particularly now that the Russian supply lines from central Russia to the Caucasus have been cut. Also, the Germans have now had time to bring up reinforcements into the Kerch Peninsula, and so their drive could be started simultaneously from two different points, one at Rostov and the other from across the Kerch Strait. With a new situation that seems to be developing on the Russian front, the Germans and Italians have been trying to excuse their ineffective activity in North Africa. They say now that the fate of Egypt depends on the fate of the Caucasus. If the threat to the Caucasus becomes critical, say these Axis spokesmen, then England cannot concentrate her efforts on the defense of Egypt. When that time comes, they continue, then it will be Rommel's time to strike with a new reinforcement which he has received. In this total war, the step from the Russian and Egyptian fronts to the Finnish front is not very great. The recent American action in ending Finnish consular activity in the United States is one based on diplomatic grounds. And yet, the so-called Finnish surprise expressed at this action is understandable when one considers present-day Finnish mentality. It is perhaps the same kind of surprise which they expressed when the British came with their declaration of war. At that time, high Finnish diplomatic circles told me, quote, our strategic line is just about reached, and a little more patience will clear up our part in the war, end quote. Yet what we find, the so-called Finnish strategic line is apparently not yet reached, and here it is 8 months since the British declared war on them. This is David Anderson returning you now to New York.
Our news roundup continues from the critical Middle Eastern theater of war. We take you now to Cairo.
Hello, New York. This is Grant Parr speaking from Cairo, Egypt. In the big armored battle fought Thursday on the Alamein front, 25 enemy tanks were knocked out by British tanks and field pieces. To make sure that they would never see action again, British sappers afterward blew up and completely destroyed 21 of these tanks. Fighting continued today on both sides, and every side appeared reluctant to involve their tanks. From the northern sector, the Australians and some South Africans drove southward and took two ridges. Then, the Germans counterattacked and retook the southernmost ridge. The action continued on the ridge which the Aussies had first occupied. Enemy truck-borne infantry attacked Indian positions on the central ridge, but the Indians drove them off. These operations leave the Axis forces in the pocket, which has hardly caused them much concern. And the pocket has grown a bit tighter. Major General Lewis Brereton, veteran of America's air war in the Philippines, Java, India, and Burma, is now in command of the United States Army Air Force in the Middle East. In the 36 days our Air Force has been in operation here, it has carried out 21 tactical missions, missions that have involved actual attacks running into three figures. Bombs have been dropped by the scores of tons. Concentrating on Axis convoys and Axis supply posts, the American Air Force has been out both on night raids and high altitude precision bombing day raids. Some of its jobs have been highly dangerous, and there have been losses, but they have been surprisingly light. Three bombers have been lost by enemy action in the Middle East. We have suffered no further casualties. The Americans have shot down five enemy warplanes, mostly Germany's crack fighters, the Messerschmitt 109. Last night, American heavy bombers thundered in over Tobruk Harbor just at dusk, both on the destruction of Axis ships and the vital cargoes of munitions they are bringing to Marshal Rommel. The big bombers got several direct hits on a large motor vessel and set fire to an oil tanker. Nearby in the Gulf of Bombay, other Americans raided Axis supply boats. This is Grant Farr in Cairo returning you to New York.
And now to London for the report of John McVane.
This is London. Military quarters in London today say the main fighting in Egypt is centered on the important Rawasat Ridge. The Germans are anxious to recapture it. In the south, it's said there's only patrol activity, probably on a larger scale than we were accustomed to before the present battle opened. A lone German raider bombed and machine-gunned a town on the south coast of England this morning. Casualties are said to be about a dozen. There's continued evidence here that the British will take a firm line with the French naval vessels in Alexandria if the necessity arises. The authoritative London Times says that if the need does arise, the removal and disposal of the French ships must lie with Britain and no one else. The Times says of Laval's orders to Admiral Godefroy that it is odd, if not disturbing, that Laval should be allowed to communicate with a French officer in a British naval base. There's been some anxiety here about the fact that the American government tried to negotiate with Laval about the ships, which are governed by the, not by the armistice terms, but by the arrangement between the British and French admirals. The London Financial Weekly, The Economist, today points out that trucks and other vehicles are reaching Rommel through Tunisia, so Petain is really giving direct military aid to the Axis. The Economist traces the various American offers to Vichy on the subject of the French Navy vessels, and notes that only at the end of the offers did the United States decide Britain would be justified in sinking the ships if an attempt were made to hand them over to German control. The Weekly calls the incident striking evidence of a state of mind that might have very dangerous consequences if ever the military needs of the United Nations were to come into sudden and violent conflict with the authority claimed by Vichy. The Labor Daily Herald today asked that Mr. Eden go to Washington to straighten out with Mr. Cordell Hull coordination between the State Department and the Foreign Office. Some British commentators are remembering today is the sixth anniversary of the beginning of the Spanish War. In that war, the Axis openly tested the war methods they're using now. Yesterday, I heard Jan Masaryk, the Czechoslovak deputy prime minister, recall the horror that most people felt when German bombers blasted the unprotected Spanish village of Guernica. As the position seems here, Spain is not fighting openly on the Axis side for only one reason, her internal weakness. There have been persistent rumors that Spanish territory is being used for German air and U-boat bases. What is certain is that Axis agents in Algeciras, just across the harbor from Gibraltar, use Spanish territory as a constant observation post. This is John McVane in London, returning you to New York.
This has been a roundup of the news with Robert Magadoff from Moscow, Richard Harkness from Washington, David Anderson from Stockholm, Grant Parr from Cairo, and John McVane from London. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station. This is the National Broadcasting Company.